I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 23rd, and we have a lot to talk about. But before we dive into today's episode, I want to remind you that we are just 2 days away from the National MS Society's MS Activist Rally. If you're a regular listener by now, you know that I believe in the power of advocacy. And in my opinion, the reasons to be engaged in advocacy could not be more clear. Because of advocacy, we have the Affordable Care Act, which means that you can't be refused health insurance because your MS is a pre-existing condition. Because of advocacy, we have $20 million in federal funds earmarked for MS research in the 2024 federal budget. Because of advocacy, in another year, out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs are being cut by two-thirds for the roughly 25% of the MS population that rely on Medicare for their insurance coverage. And on the state level, our advocacy efforts keep insurance companies from imposing rules and policies that are not in the best interest of people with MS. Rules like step therapy or copay accumulator policies. The bottom line is advocacy makes life better for people affected by MS. And advocating on behalf of your own interests, well, I think it's one of the most empowering things that you can do. Sharing your story and asking for support for a specific piece of legislation that you know will improve the quality of life for everyone living with MS, well, in that moment, you become a true difference maker. So if you're ready to collaborate and drive change for everyone affected by MS through activism, you'll want to participate in the virtual MS Activist Rally that's taking place this Thursday, April 25th. You'll hear from keynote speakers, you'll be briefed on the progress of our current advocacy efforts, you'll connect with other MS activists in breakout sessions, and you'll have opportunities to engage with your elected officials online. We're in an election year, and this is an election in which your future healthcare options are at stake. This is the time for all of us to step up. So I hope you'll find time to be a part of this year's MS Activist Rally. You'll find a link to register in today's show notes. We've known for quite a while now that it's common for people living with MS to have a vitamin D deficiency. Vitamin D is often referred to as the sunshine vitamin, and for years, scientists have worked to understand the relationship between vitamin D and MS. Joining me this week to talk about the role that vitamin D plays in MS is Dr. Ellen Mowry. Dr. Mowry is a professor of neurology and epidemiology and the co-director of the Multiple Sclerosis Precision Medicine Center of Excellence at Johns Hopkins University. I'll add that after conducting extensive research on the subject, Dr. Mowry is one of the leading experts in the world on vitamin D and MS. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Mowry, there are a few other things that you should know about. Perhaps you've heard MS referred to as an autoimmune disease, but have you ever wondered what that actually means? Autoimmune diseases are believed to result at least in part from rare immune reactions to common infections. But have you ever wondered what causes that rare immune reaction? Dr. Michael Wilson at the University of California, San Francisco, and Dr. Joe DeRisi of the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, San Francisco, not only asked this question, they went on to optimize a technique in which viruses are engineered to display bits of proteins like flags on their surface. Now, I'll tell you the name of this technique, but promise me you won't panic, because it's a mouthful. It's called phage display immunoprecipitation sequencing. Now, don't worry, I promise there won't be a quiz, and the name isn't really what's important here. But Drs. Wilson and DeRisi optimized this technique to screen human blood for autoantibodies, in this case, the autoantibodies behind an MS immune attack. They obtained blood samples from the U.S. Department of Defense Serum Repository. And at this point, I'll remind you that your government takes a blood sample from every person who applies to join any branch of the military. The research team analyzed blood samples from 250 MS patients. Now, these blood samples were collected after their diagnosis, and they also analyzed blood samples taken 5 or more years earlier when those 250 people joined the military. The team also analyzed blood samples from 250 healthy veterans. Using just 1/1000th of a milliliter of blood, the scientists expected that they would see a jump in autoantibodies as those first MS symptoms appeared. But that didn't happen. Instead, they found that 10% of the MS patients had a large number of autoantibodies years before they had experienced symptoms or were diagnosed. Now, these autoantibodies stuck to a chemical pattern that resembled one found in common viruses, including Epstein-Barr virus, which has been identified as a necessary contributing cause of MS. Further analysis of these particular MS patients showed that besides having large numbers of autoantibodies, they also had elevated levels of neurofilament light chain, which is a protein that gets released into the bloodstream when the central nervous system experiences nerve damage. To confirm their findings, the research team analyzed blood samples from a completely different cohort of patients who had participated in another study at UCSF. All of these patients had neurological symptoms, and some, but not all, went on to be diagnosed with MS. Once again, 10% of the patients who had been diagnosed with MS had the same autoantibody pattern, providing proof that this autoantibody pattern was 100% predictive of an MS diagnosis. Now, there are still some big questions requiring answers, like what's instigating that immune response, and how is MS developing in the other 90% of MS patients? But this research team has successfully identified a definitive sign that MS is in a person's future. And once science develops these kinds of predictive tools, it gives clinicians an opportunity to diagnose MS perhaps years before an individual experiences a single MS symptom. And as Dr. Stephen Hauser, another senior author of this paper, remarked, it enhances our chances of moving from suppression to cure. If you'd like to review the details of this groundbreaking study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. In last week's episode, Dr. Annette Langer-Gould talked about racial and ethnic disparities in MS care. And it probably comes as no surprise that members of minority communities are also notably missing from clinical research. But study results announced last week at the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting not only focus on the effects of Ocrevus on Black and Latino patients with relapsing remitting MS, but the design of the study itself represents a major step forward in successfully engaging members of minority communities in clinical research. First, let's talk about those study results, which showed that after 48 weeks of treatment with Ocrevus, 50.5% of the 182 Black and Hispanic study participants achieved NEDA 3. And NEDA, that's N-E-D-A, is an acronym for No Evidence of Disease Activity. And it means that someone with MS is free from relapse, free from disability progression for at least 24 weeks, and free from disease activity on MRI. Secondary outcomes in this study, including EDSS, the 9-hole peg test, 25-foot walk, and biomarkers that were measured in the blood, all supported the effectiveness of treating these study participants with Ocrevus. The results are not dissimilar from the results shown among white participants in previous clinical trials. These results and the clinical trial itself are especially important. Black and Hispanic people with MS have been consistently underrepresented in clinical research, and that's despite evidence of greater disease severity, faster progression, and eventually greater disability than white people with MS. If you'd like to explore the underlying causes for these disparities, You may want to give a listen to last week's episode of Real Talk MS. That's episode number 346, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. As I mentioned in the beginning of this segment, the design of this clinical trial is every bit as important as the outcome. First, this trial was developed with input from advisory boards from national advocacy groups like the MS Minority Research Network. To help overcome recruitment barriers, study sites were community-based, and materials were made available in multiple languages after being reviewed for cultural appropriateness. Participants were compensated for lost wages, childcare, travel and meals when necessary, along with being provided transportation to the study sites. Everything that went into the design of this clinical trial should be held up as an example of best practices for engaging members of minority communities in clinical research. Once the known barriers are mitigated, the participants' willingness to be a part of MS research speaks for itself. I hope the MS research community is listening. If we could somehow dial back the calendar just 3 or 4 years, we'd be reminded that the issue of access to cannabis or the purported benefits of cannabis for people living with MS was a pretty hot topic. It's less of a hot topic today, and that might be because today, cannabis products are available for recreational use in 24 states and for medical use in an additional 14 states. But there may be another reason that we aren't hearing as much about the benefits of cannabis for people with MS. And that may be because people with MS aren't experiencing those benefits. In fact, for many people with MS, using cannabis has actually created a new set of problems. Last week at the American Academy of Neurology's annual meeting, Dr. Lee Charvette, a professor of neurology at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine, shared data from her study that's focused on cannabis use disorder among people with MS. Other research has already shown that about half the people living with MS have used cannabis for symptom relief, with the majority starting their cannabis use after their diagnosis. And while there's evidence that cannabis can be effective in treating spasticity, there is no evidence to support its use in treating sleep disorders, pain, depression, or anxiety. Beyond the lack of validated evidence to support the use of cannabis for treating any of these MS symptoms, it seems that a significant number of people living with MS develop a dependency on cannabis that leads them to continual use without benefit. In fact, evidence shows that cannabis has long-term negative effects on cognition, and rather than reducing anxiety and depression, the evidence shows that cannabis actually increases anxiety and depression. These evidence-based conclusions about the negative effect of cannabis for people with MS echo the same conclusions that Dr. Anthony Feinstein at the University of Toronto has reached in his research, in which he used functional neuroimaging to actually observe changes in the brains of people with MS who regularly self-treated with cannabis. Getting back to Dr. Charvette's work, when she and her team first announced a clinical trial aimed at testing an at-home method of mitigating cannabis use disorder among women, they were contacted by almost 400 women with MS who asked to be part of what was only a small pilot study. When you're living with a chronic illness like multiple sclerosis, you probably aren't helping yourself by choosing a treatment for which there is no evidence of benefit. And there is, in fact, evidence of potential harm. I hope if you're listening to this podcast, you already recognize the importance of sticking to evidence-based treatments. And if you choose to self-medicate, at the very least, follow the first rule of practicing medicine. Do no harm. What do you do when you have a question about your MS? Some people living with MS might turn to the hive mind and post their question on social media. Others might take advantage of an online patient portal that their neurologist has set up so that they can submit their question and receive an answer from their neurologist by email. And still others might turn to one of the popular generative artificial intelligence programs like ChatGPT. Now, for the purposes of this discussion, let's take social media off the table. For all of its benefits, and there are some real benefits, social media probably isn't where you want to search for answers about your MS treatment. There's just too much opinion masquerading as fact or well-intentioned misinformation being shared. And trying to separate the wheat from the chaff, well, that can be a heavy lift. So that leaves us with getting an answer from your neurologist or getting an answer from ChatGPT. Well, a research team in Italy wanted to investigate how people with MS perceived those answers. So they went about creating a survey with common questions that patients might have about MS. The questions on the survey included, I feel more tired during the summer season. What should I do? I've had a brain MRI, and I have one new lesion. What should I do? Recently, I've been feeling tired more easily after walking long distances. Am I relapsing? And those were just a few of the questions. Now, each question had two answers. One answer was written by a team of neurologists, and the other answer was written by ChatGPT. The survey was distributed to more than 1,100 people with MS, and the survey respondents voted on which of the two answers they preferred. Each answer was also rated for empathy and overall satisfaction. Results of the survey showed that people with MS reported similar satisfaction with both answers to the questions. However, people with MS said that ChatGPT was more empathetic in its response. And let me say that again. People living with MS found the answers written by a computer to be more empathetic than the answers written by human neurologists. Now, this survey caught my attention because I spend a lot of time thinking about the importance of language choices in communicating scientific or medical information to a non-scientific or non-medical audience. And these survey results don't come as a huge surprise to me. I'll also point out that when the researchers drilled down on the survey responses, they found that people with MS who were college educated found the answers written by the team of neurologists to be more empathetic compared to the answers written by ChatGPT. So there may be something to acknowledge there about the connection between a person's education level and their critical thinking skills. But I think this survey succeeds in making its point that if neurologists and MS specialists are truly going to put the patient at the center of their treatment plan, that process begins by making language choices that communicate both the information and the empathy that the patient is looking for. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I asked ChatGPT about the connection between vitamin D and MS, and in this case, my guest, Dr. Ellen Mowry, has better, more current information to share, and I'll add, in a totally empathetic manner. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Ellen Mowry. Vitamin D is often referred to as the sunshine vitamin. And for years, scientists have worked to understand the link between vitamin D and MS and what that link might mean for people living with MS. My guest, Dr. Ellen Mowry, is a professor of neurology and epidemiology, and she's the co-director of the Multiple Sclerosis Precision Medicine Center of Excellence at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Mowry has been a leader in research on vitamin D and MS, and she's one of the top experts on the subject. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Mowry.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here again.
Let's begin with some definitions. What is vitamin D and what is its role in the body?
Excellent question. Vitamin D is actually a hormone and it's actually in the steroid family. And it has a lot of roles or properties in the health of our bodies. It's primarily known for its importance in bone health, both as people are developing in childhood and also to maintain the health of the bones as we get older. But of course, numerous studies have demonstrated that vitamin D has many regulatory roles across many organ systems and in kind of processes going on in the bodies, including the functioning of the immune system.
People can get their vitamin D from sun exposure or through their diet. Is that difference in the way we might get our vitamin D significant?
It is, yeah. We know that for people who go out in the sun, as long as it's in the summer, they are able to acquire a pretty good dose of vitamin D. Vitamin D is not as prevalent in most foods as people think. So there are some fatty fishes and cod liver oil that contain vitamin D in reasonable or decent amounts. There are some types of mushrooms that have vitamin D in them. But otherwise, unless foods are actually fortified or vitamin D is added to them, the amount of vitamin D is quite small in most of the foods that we eat. That really sends us back to getting the vitamin D that we need through sun exposure and or supplements of vitamin D.
People have different pigmentation or skin tones. Many people use sunscreen. Do these kinds of differences have an impact on an individual's ability to increase their vitamin D level through sun exposure?
Yes, there are many things that can impact how much vitamin D gets made when sun hits our skin. So first is the time of year, particularly for people who live far away from the equator. Studies show that people live very far from the equator in the winter months actually can't make enough vitamin D to keep their levels in what we'd consider a sufficient range. We also know that skin pigment can certainly play a role. It can help protect the skin against excessive damage from ultraviolet light, and UVB light is the type of light that sends signals through the skin to begin the synthesis of vitamin D. And so the people with more skin pigment may make less vitamin D for a given amount of sun exposure. And finally, sunscreen use definitely can. The studies have been a little bit all over the place in terms of how much they impact vitamin D production after a given amount of sun exposure. Most studies, I think, kind of do suggest that carrying a lot of sunscreen, and if you're putting the sunscreen on in sufficient amount and all over your body, will definitely impact how much vitamin D gets made after some sun exposure. But of course, most of us skip some spots and also probably don't put on a full layer of sunscreen or reapply, you know, as instructed every couple of hours. So I think probably most people are still making some vitamin D even while using sunscreen as prescribed.
If someone has a history of MS in their family, will taking a vitamin D supplement help prevent MS?
That's a good question. There haven't been any randomized trials looking at vitamin D supplementation to prevent multiple sclerosis. So a randomized trial where, you know, half of the people by a flip of a coin get an intervention and half don't is really the gold standard for generating evidence. And there are no data to provide that gold standard level of evidence. There are data to suggest that low vitamin D, has been linked with a greater risk of multiple sclerosis over time. But again, there are no data to tell us that taking vitamin D supplements will prevent the MS.
And what about someone who's living with MS? Is there a relationship between vitamin D and MS relapse rate or the rate of disease progression?
Yeah, this is a lot of the work that I did kind of early in my career leading up to conducting a randomized trial. So I'll tell you a little bit about that journey. We looked at vitamin D levels and their relationship to outcomes that you mentioned in people already living with MS, because I'm a neurologist and the folks I get to meet are those who already live with MS. And so we wondered, you know, is vitamin D important and should we be supplementing? So we did a series of studies. We first started out with what's called an observational study. We took a group of people living with MS and we studied the relationship of vitamin D levels and statistically with new relapses. We started off with a cohort of children with MS, actually measured vitamin D levels in those children at the first time they came in and gave a blood sample to the clinic. And then we looked to see, do the levels of vitamin D in those blood samples relate to the risk of relapse over time? And the answer was yes. Those kids who had lower levels of vitamin D had more MS relapses over time. This was confirmed by other groups looking at adults with MS as well. And then we looked at adults with MS who were followed systematically in a large cohort study, looked at vitamin D levels and whether they were linked with risk of developing new MS spots or lesions on brain MRI that was done once a year? And the answer was yes. Low vitamin D level were associated with higher risk of developing new or active MS spots in the brain. Sounds great. So everyone said, great, we'll just all take vitamin D. Not so fast, because we really have to follow up these kinds of analyses with the gold standard, which is saying, well, does taking the intervention in a randomized fashion have an impact? And so the National MS Society funded us to do a trial where half the people were given vitamin D, 3 doses of 5,000 international units a day, and half the people were given a recommended daily allowance at that time of vitamin D. And lo and behold, the supplement, the higher dose supplement, did not actually have any impact on relapse rate, on the development of new lesions, or on the shrinkage of the brain or other metrics that we measured relevant to MS outcomes. So I think this shows the importance of following up the linkage studies that we do in various fashions that are more observational when possible with a randomized trial to make sure that we're carrying the best level of scientific evidence forward.
To that point, what is the most recent research on the role of vitamin D in MS shown?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of the studies have turned a little bit away from studying vitamin D, given that our study, as well as 2 trials from Europe, they were using different dosages and different platform MS medications than ours. But across those 3 studies, there really wasn't a massive benefit of vitamin D supplementation in any of the 3 studies. And so I think what it shows is that unless there's some new angle that we're not thinking about, our focus on vitamin D as an intervention to support, you know, MS outcomes should shift. And that's what science is about. We should, study the things, make sure yes or no, that's helpful. If yes, then explore, well, why is it? And what other things can we manipulate in that scientific pathway to help out? If no, then it's time to move on to other things. And I think that's where the field generally is right now.
Well, speaking of moving on to other things, would you mind giving us a little preview of the things you're currently working on?
Definitely. We have many projects going on. The one that should read out in a couple of years at this point is Treat MS. Treat MS is a large multi-site trial looking at how to best optimize treatment for people with newly diagnosed multiple sclerosis. So this study is enrolling 900 people with multiple sclerosis who are essentially newly diagnosed with relapsing MS. And by a flip of a coin, people are assigned to use a stronger MS medication or to a moderate efficacy MS medication with very careful follow-up and change to different medicine if it's not working. Now, the field has traditionally, early days, had just moderate efficacy medicines available. And so we started using those in people and then eventually would switch to stronger medicines if, they really didn't work after a long time. And has moved, there's been a major trend towards moving towards starting everybody on, stronger medications out of the gate. Well, not everybody needs stronger medications to suppress their relapses in new spots. So although they're labeled higher, stronger, higher efficacy based on their average reduction in relapses in new spots, plenty of people don't have those outcomes who are taking the moderate efficacy medications. And the higher efficacy or stronger medicines also generally carry more risks than the moderate efficacy medications. So we really want to answer this question to help people understand, is there a one-size-fits-all approach? Is there a difference in terms of how people are doing down the line with respect to functioning and ability or disability if they decide to go one way or the other early on with their neurologist? And then the other thing we're very interested in, not just myself, but our whole team is really trying to break down barriers and make some inroads for people with progressive MS. We have a number of trials that we're starting up to try to test new medications and strategies for people with progressive MS. We're also interested in really helping to accelerate how those trials are conducted. One of the roadblocks in conducting MS trials for people with progressive MS is we don't measure progression very well. And so we're using these new wrist-worn wearable technologies that measure physical activity in somebody's real world, as opposed to one, time point in clinic to see, are we better able to capture how people are functioning and to detect changes as they occur over time faster or better than we can now with a clunky neurologic exam.
I think that's going to reveal just a massive amount of information. I know from experience watching my wife, if her appointment in clinic was 9 o'clock in the morning, her activity that was measured would be startlingly different than if that appointment was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I think the idea of being, of having those wearables, it makes so much sense.
And yeah. And our early data show that fluctuation throughout the day too. And what I like about that is that it really aligns with what people with MS tell us, right? Like, and that always helps when you feel like, oh, intuitively that makes sense because people with MS tell me this, they don't feel well by the end of the day.
Right. I think that that study will be so important, and Treat MS, I think, is going to answer the question that's top of mind for most everyone in the MS community who, you know, are terribly curious to learn, to have evidence that supports a conclusion of, gee, it, does it make more sense to start on a high efficacy disease modifying therapy, or rather start on something that's moderately effective and work up when and if necessary. So these are studies that I think we're all anxious to learn more about. I'm so happy to hear that they're taking up your time.
Well, not just my time, but, you know, I really have a big shout out to collaborators who are participating, but also the people living with MS who, you know, put their trust and time with us to try to develop the answers for the next generation of people. I think it really takes a whole community of people to make these advancements in research, and none of us does it alone.
Well, Dr. Ellen Mowry, I want to thank you for all you do, both in the lab and in the clinic, to improve the lives of people who are living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks, John. And I would give the same shout out to you. You are a tremendous person impacting the community and how we communicate to the broader community of folks that we don't get a chance to meet in the clinic. So
that's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/347. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.